All right, my name is Dean Wells. I'm a program manager in the Windows Server team. I own a technology referred to as shielded VMs. This particular session, though, is a little different. The goal of this session isn't so much to talk about the technology and the security capabilities and how we built the attestation componentry. This is about operationalizing it, actually deploying it. And as far as we know, there is precisely one production deployment of a guarded fabric in the world at this point, since Windows Server's not yet released, and that is with BrightSolid. So Kenny will come up a little bit later, and he's going to give you about how many months, Kenny, just yell it out, how many months you've been deploying for?
A year and a half.
So a year and a half worth of experience as to the things that they had to do that were specific to guarded fabric deployments. Obviously, with this security layered on top of regular Hyper-V, there are additional things that you have to build. There are additional deployments, additional areas of scale concern. That is the goal of this session. What we then did is, obviously, Kenny has been working in partnership with Dell, as you can tell. So we brought Terry from Dell along. Terry and I have known each other for an awful long time. He has an accent similar to mine, though not quite as nice. He's not agreeing, but that's the fact. It just is. What Terry's going to talk to you about is the way in which they have now rebuilt this on top of some of the other arguably unrelated features that Server 2016 supports, such as the hyperconverged deployment model. And Terry is actually going to give you some hopefully fairly smack-in-the-face price differences between what you could achieve on 2012 R2 at this price point and what you can achieve at that same price point with 2016 using some hyperconverged and converged deployment models. That's the reason that I've got Kenny and Terry here. So what I'll do then to kick it off is I'm going to keep it nice and simple and short, but this apparently I need to be... There, right, so that's as far as I can go. I won't go any further. What the heck is a shielded VM? How many of you have already seen a session where I or someone else talked about shielded VMs? Quick show of hands, because I can actually see you. So most of you, no, about 50%. All right, I'll keep this one short then so that you can actually get a sense for what it's about. So effectively, shielded VMs is a new technology that we deemed necessary because of an attack vector that we spotted a good 4 or 5 years ago. Our trustworthy computing group and Microsoft Research were doing a lot of research into basic attacks that existed in the industry, and they started to identify a common element in each of them. That common element was the abuse of admin credentials. It doesn't matter whether it's past the hash. It doesn't matter whether it's malware. It doesn't matter whether it's a fabric attack. It doesn't matter whether it's a disk attack. They all leveraged administrative privilege. So we realized that, well, in that case, there is actually another attack vector that we've done nothing for because there is an admin that exists today by virtue of the way we handle virtualization. We call them fabric admins. The problem got worse when hypervisor became the default deployment means for new workloads. We used to do everything on bare metal, and there would be a few outliers that we shoved as VMs, right? When the performance of a VM was always brought into question. Finally, the performance of a VM got to the point where we no longer care about the difference between it and its bare metal counterpart because it's practically imperceivable. You can't even tell. So we started utilizing the hardware that we've got far more effectively, and the notion of a private cloud was built. That private cloud then had a private cloud admin, and then all this tooling and management and fabric tools were built up around it. And then eventually the public cloud came along, and the problem was getting steadily worse. A fabric admin can now gain access to absolutely any workload running as a virtual machine. Take a SAN admin, a Hyper-V instance with its disks stored on a SAN. Can the SAN admin copy off an Active Directory domain controller? Trivially. What about a printer admin? No, that was a mistake on my last session. We actually had that in there. Somebody put printer admin in the mechanics session I did earlier on, and I had to make an excuse for why it was in there. But printer admins, no, I don't think they can, because they don't exist anymore. We shot them all. They're not necessary. But fabric admins, they're just not needed. Fabric admins definitely do have that capability. And you can't encrypt the disks. I would love for somebody to disagree with me. Can you encrypt the disk of a shielded... yes, you can. Can you encrypt the disk of a VM in a manner that is worth doing? Not really. The reason I say that is because the cipher is one aspect of encryption technology that has to be good. You need a good cipher. If you're using a 20-year-old encryption cipher, then today's wristwatches are probably going to crack it. If you're using a modern cipher, the next thing that you have is a secure key release mechanism. What is the best secure key release mechanism we have for bare metal hardware today? I hear it coming from everywhere. TPM, Trusted Platform Modules. Do we have a VTPM? No. Yes. No, we didn't. Yes, now we do. That's what shielded VMs are built on. But obviously, a TPM is valuable, is useful, is treated as something in which you can root your trust, because it is silicone, because if it's attacked, it tends to break it. They are designed to break if physically attacked. How do you do that with a VTPM? Well, that was one of the hard things that we had to build. But that is effectively what a guarded fabric does. It gives you the ability to protect VMs from attacks by SAN admins, fabric admins, printer admins, network admins, and anybody else you care to mention, by implementing rigorous health attestation protocols that ensure the Hyper-V host on which the shielded VM is running is absolutely known to be healthy and cannot impersonate anyone else, and then providing those same bare metal-like devices in a synthetic form to the guest operating system. So when you create a shielded VM, it thinks it's got a TPM. It doesn't know any different. BitLocker works exactly the same way with that TPM as it does on one of your laptops. That's effectively what we've built, and we refer to that as a guarded fabric. So the goal here then, do we have another clicker? This one's dying on me. Let's go through here then and just talk about the requirements. We need a place to run the shielded VM. It has to be free from malware. Imagine the malware was running as a kernel mode process. What faith could you place in the shielded VM to do anything? Pretty much none. The software has to be trustworthy. We achieve that trustworthiness by, again, rigorously measuring the health of the host. We use TPM artifacts to begin with. Then we measure the boot path, which is something referred to as the UEFI or UEFI, secure measured boot, and a TCG log. That TCG log is a representation of everything the machine did to get from off to running. We then go ahead and we measure something referred to as the hypervisor enforced code integrity policy. All of these things constitute health to us. You can't attach a debugger to the host. If you do, we measure it. And therefore, we refuse to give you the keys to work with the shielded VMs. If you try and attach a debugger to the process, you probably couldn't run the debugger because the code integrity policy would block it. If somehow you manage to make that happen, the process in which a shielded VM runs is a special kernel process referred to as a protected process, specifically a PPL, protected process light. They do not permit other processes to be attached to them. Therefore, memory inspection is not possible. You can't get a VM console connection to it because that requires you to attach a process to it. All of this I'm talking about now, this is not really what we want to talk about here. I just want to make sure you understand why BrightSolid and why Dell are so in on this notion of deploying shielded VMs that they're prepared to come and stand on stage with an idiot like me and explain how they deployed it. It's risky getting on stage with me, I'll grant you. I do have a rather large ego, and I like being up here. So. Anyway, let's move on. So we have to verify that the host is in a healthy state. We need to make sure that the process that releases the keys only does so to known healthy hosts. And when we do release them, we have to make sure that the key can't be inspected in transit or inspected on the host by, yet again, a malicious admin. A lot of people have said to me, well, if I'm an admin on a Hyper-V host and you're saying that the code integrity policy is all important, what if I just delete the code integrity policy? What are you going to do about that? Well, if you delete the code integrity policy, the only way to make that affect runtime now is reboot the box. The moment you reboot the box, we take new boot measurements. You try and get a health certificate from us, and we go, no, you're not healthy. You remove the code integrity policy. This is called Device Guard. It's part of Windows 10 and part of Windows Server 2016. If you want to take it one step further, you can. Imagine the Hyper-V host was installed in a cage with two padlocks, two, because collusion makes it much harder for an individual attacker to do anything. So you've got two padlocks. It's got a camera on it. Now, let's see, how can I go ahead and physically access that? I can't. Physical access is precluded. The security did good. So they decide to delete the code integrity policy and reboot the box. If you configured it as locked, that effectively means that the box will come up, it'll look for a signature of the code integrity policy in its firmware, in UEFI, saved, and it'll say, I've got one. What's the current signature of the code integrity policy? Oh, there isn't one. What do you think Windows does when configured with locked device guard, hypervisor enforced code integrity? Blue screens. Because you chose to lock the policy, because a blue screen was preferable to potentially leaking secretive assets. So all of this stuff is part and parcel of 10 and of Server 2016, and they all constitute a guarded fabric. We knit all these features together, stitch them into one. Okay, guarded hosts. This is the Hyper-V host itself. All I'll mention here is it has to be healthy, it has to run Windows Server 2016, it has to be configured to use a host guardian service, and it has to be using Data Center Edition. Shielded VMs are only supported on Data Center Edition. This is a pain in the neck, perhaps, but most other versions of Windows will only limit you to 4 virtual machines, so it's not really an issue for those of you that are serious about it. The host guardian service. This is a separate Windows Server 2016 role. You add it using Server Manager, and you configure it. Typically, we might recommend a 3-node bare metal cluster. This will run on just about any commodity server hardware you've got today with the same performance demands, similar at least, to an Active Directory domain controller. Now, I would argue that I could run an Active Directory domain controller in a VM on my laptop, and I could authenticate all of you simultaneously if you were domain joined to it. Anyone care to differ? Exactly. So HGS's performance demands are fairly easy to cater to. So you deploy that as a separate workload. Windows Server Standard Edition has that as well. Two types of shielding, and then I'm going to hand it over to Kenny after this. One we refer to as shielded. This is where you get all the protections. You can't console connect. The thing is effectively a black box to a Fabric admin of nothingness. The only thing it does is suck out resources from their Hyper-V instance, but they can't do anything to it. No PowerShell Direct, no console connection, no KVP exchange, no file copy integration component, no attaching a debugger, no running admin tools that we don't bless. None of those things are possible. However, with an encrypted-supported VM, encryption-supported, rather, not our best branding, I'll grant you, but that's what we're going out the door with, this is for a slightly different scenario. The scenario this best suits to is compliance, where you need to check a box that says data is encrypted at rest. Check. Data is encrypted in flight. That's down to you. Make sure the workload uses an encrypted protocol. But live migration is also encrypted in flight, right? An encryption supported and a shielded VM all use derived keys to ensure that every live migration attempt is encrypted, regardless of whether it's shielded or encryption supported. And we also pre-assess the target host to ensure that they are able to pass the health tests. Otherwise, it would be pointless sending the VM there because they couldn't run it. All of that happens for free. So you basically make that decision according to whether you want true blue security as well as compliance, or do you just want compliance? Check a box. Encryption supported works for that mode. It does still bring security. It does still preclude offline attacks, but it doesn't do as much for the online runtime attacks. If we do have a better clicker, AV guy, I'd really appreciate it. This one is just not working. Optionally, System Center Virtual Machine Manager. This is optional. A lot of people have asked me this already, so I added it. You can build a guarded fabric out of just Hyper-V if you want to, and there is a rich PowerShell management surface. But you know, PowerShell does require a little bit of expertise, so typically people like to build on top. VMM would be the next layer. Third parties are also already beginning to support this. I'm chatting, and I'll go only as far as that, I'm chatting with Five9 to see if they'll lend support to guarded fabrics, and OpenStack have already done it. So there is already a running implementation of OpenStack that fully supports shielded virtual machines and all of the artifacts to configure them. On top of that, Azure Pack can be used. It's fully enlightened to shielded virtual machines as well, and then Active Directory can be there or not. That's kind of a rare thing, right? We don't need AD to manage the fabric of Hyper-V hosts. That is your choice. We do need AD for certain configurations, but that's a different thing. We don't need it for management purposes. Down to you. All right, so at this point, I'd like to give Kenny welcome to the stage. Give him a quick round of applause. Kenny from BrightSolid, that's in Scotland.
Thank you. Hopefully this works for me. Doesn't it get you excited about shielded VMs? Hands up if you now want to deploy shielded VMs. Hands up. I'm not going on until every hand's up. Okay, this is where I was about a year and a half ago, May 8th, 2015. That was Ignite last year. And I watched Dean's session. I wasn't here. I watched his session on VM shielding. And I knew then we had to deploy this. We needed this feature in our data centers. But as he was speaking about it, he said, no one has this deployed right now. I know this for a fact because the hardware to support it doesn't exist yet. He said that, and it really rankled me. I wanted it then, but I couldn't have it. We also happened to be at the point of refreshing all our hardware, our Hyper-V hardware, and I wanted to buy hardware that could support VM shielding, but the TPM2 chips that we needed didn't exist. Okay, so what do you do then? You engage with your OEM. You feed them lots of wine. That works. And what we did was we built a tested, validated reference architecture for 2012 R2, that we could then extend TPM2s into and bring into 2016 right out of the gate. So at GA, we can upgrade directly to 2016 and know that we get all this rich features out of VM shielding. So I want to talk about three things basically today. I want to talk about who we are. I want to talk about why VM shielding is important to us, and I want to tell you the lessons we've learned over the last year and a half about operationalizing this fabric, because there are a lot of things that were like, oh, moments for me that I hadn't thought of that I think will be really valuable to share with the community at large. The who about Bright Solid isn't self-indulgent fluff. It's vital to the context and vital to padding out the session. So Bright Solid is a managed service provider, cloud service provider based in Scotland. Scotland, for those of you who don't know, is a small country just north of England, slightly smaller than the Georgia World Congress Center. We've been around for about 20 years. We started off as an ISP. We have a great, strong network backbone throughout the country as a result of this. It's all 10 gig, low latency connectivity throughout. We own and operate our own Tier 3 data centers. Today, we own and operate the only Uptime Institute certified Tier 3 colo and hosting facilities in the country. We primarily focus on the public, energy, finance sectors. You recognize these as people that really need strong security. Actually, can we get some hands up about where everyone's from? How many people are service providers here? A few. Enterprise? Public sector? Other? Okay, I don't know what other is. So all of these customers that we have need security and data assurance. Security and data assurance are like my catchphrases now. They're two core pillars of our business, and they're two core pillars of Windows Server 2016. It's a match made in heaven for us. So our ethos when we're talking to our customers and building out solutions for them is technical innovation backed by personal service. So we know all our customers. We know them intimately. We always try to make sure that they have a strong roadmap to the future so that when they onboard with us, they know that they're going to be set for the next 2, 3, 5+ years, and that the solution that they've bought into isn't going to go obsolete. So I run our emerging technologies team, and we're dedicated to keeping that roadmap up to date and flowing so that customers always have a clear path, clear way forward. And critically as well, I guess, we always try to underpin this with fair value. So fair value for us means we never squeeze our customers. And this is actually important for VM shielding. It's important for security, because we think that security should be inherent. It should just be there. If you need it, you can have it. I'll talk more about that later. Oh, not skipping this. We won Scotland's Best Employer Award 2015 last year, and we're now in the final for Scotland's Best Employer 2016. We are that good to work for. So this is a small snapshot of some of our customers. Probably most of them mean nothing to most of you here, but trust me, this is a good cross-section of industry in Scotland. We have people from video games, from public sector, from the NHS, from energy companies, from, well, basically whole cross-section. I won't linger, it's boring. So today, most service providers that you go to, most enterprises, have what we call standard and expected security measures. This is Derek Roy. He's our data center manager. He is that intimidating. He was a regimental sergeant major in the Royal Engineers, and he could break you like a twig. So he manages our data centers, and he manages them to as high a standard as you'd expect. And we have ISO 27001, ISO 22301, Cyber Essentials. If we were in the US, it would be FedRAMP and all that stuff. We have 24/7 access controls, CCTV, multi-factor authentication racks, et cetera, police checks for our staff. And it's boring, and this is just what should be standard and should be expected for anyone going to any service provider now. But we want to take it a leap step forward. We want to bring our customers, these really security-focused customers, into multi-tenanted cloud environments. Okay. Oftentimes, when you go and talk to a customer about moving into a multi-tenanted cloud, the card that's played is the security card. They say, who can see my data? Who can access my data? We find this within our own group of companies. So we're owned by a larger group company. There are many companies within this, and even moving those workloads into our data centers, we get the security card played. Who can see my data? They're not wrong. In order to progress beyond this expected standard way of doing things, we need to shine a bright light on the cloud security model today. We need to expose where these holes are in the cloud security model today. This is what VM shielding does. It's interesting having these conversations with customers, by the way. We have to shield that data. Yeah, it's interesting talking to customers, because the first thing you have to do when talking about VM shielding is say, what we had before, some slight holes there. We're fixing that now. It's the way of the world. It's like previous phone models. Just because the new one's out and it's the best thing ever doesn't mean the old one was shit. I'm Scottish, I can swear, it's fine. Yep. Okay, so what we designed and developed with Terry here from Dell was a 2016 tested, validated reference architecture that we'd be able to bring right up to 2016 from disk to cloud and take advantage of basically every feature that we wanted to, storage spaces direct excluded. So this we're sharing now because the next thing we buy will be different. But this is a year or so. This is what we bought a year or so ago. And this is a tested, validated 2012 R2 Dell reference architecture we have. Storage space at the bottom, two softs nodes. You ask why two softs nodes? Because we have this at two sites, and in 2016 we can make that a four-node stretch cluster. You get more resiliency there. That allows us to put two more Hyper-V hosts in the rack. The Hyper-V hosts, 14 of them there. In 2012 R2, two of them were an SDN cluster, a Hyper-V network virtualization cluster. In 2016, we can bring that role into the main Hyper-V cluster, so those Hyper-V network virtualization servers were the exact same spec as all the rest of the Hyper-V hosts. It's planning for the future. Our softs nodes, we put in dedicated Mellanox 10 gig NICs for storage replica because we knew we would need that. There are lots of other design choices in here. We also left space for host guardian servers. Can someone else say that? Yeah, you say it day in, day out. Very quickly, Dean. So all this built on Dell, built to be able to run 2016, but the TPM2 still didn't exist. So what we did was we built out the bare minimum Hyper-V hosts we needed, 2012 R2, and as soon as those TPM2 chips became available, January this year, we bought the rest of the hosts we'd need so that we could build out a 2016 cluster, and we spent since January testing, validating from a TP4 at the time, I think, on this hardware with the TPM2s, and we've learned a lot of operationalizing lessons through that process. And that's the meat of what we're going to talk about today. But before we get into the meat, another entree, I think, from entree from Terry is going to talk about the work we did on the 2012 R2 reference architectures and how we operationalized that for 2016 as well, how we prepared for 2016. Okay.
Yep. Thank you. Good afternoon. Well, I speak English, but I speak a bit slower, so hopefully you understand. So if you imagine the reference architecture that we built with Bright Solid, the bill of materials was derived out of CPS Premium. Is everyone familiar with Cloud Platform System? More hands? No? Okay, so the storage part was derived out of just a bunch of disks, JBODs, storage spaces, two nodes. But at the Hyper-V level, we worked with Bright Solid and said, well, you know what, if you want to go to TPM2, we needed a server that supported, you know, the TPM2 architecture to support VM shielding. So this architecture we built on top of 2012 R2 storage, we put 2016 as Hyper-V, and it allowed us to set aside three nodes to run TPM2 for Hyper-V VM shielding, and then we had two nodes for TPM version 1.2 for host guardian services. There's two levels of attestation. There's the Active Directory and there's the TPM. So the TPM has been used to, you know, for the host guardian services. And as Dean alluded to when he opened up the session, that you need, the recommended minimum is three physical servers for resiliency. So we've started with two. The reason why, we want to double that to four, to have two in each data center to have a stretch Hyper-V, or a stretch physical cluster. A four physical servers in a single cluster to make a resilient solution, servicing host guardian services to two separate data centers. So Windows 2016 is using SMB 302 to the scale out file server, which is running 2012 R2. Now, Bright Solid are moving that storage to 2016, and I believe, Kenny, you've already moved that storage to 2016. So there we go. I mean, the RTM code is there, and that's been upgraded now. So it's been cleaned off, and a clean install of 2016 storage spaces has been put in place. Now, one of the beautiful things around just a bunch of disks, JBODs, with 2016 in storage spaces, is you can make the storage a stretch cluster. So that means you can have synchronous replication at block level as long as your WAN link between two data centers is 5 milliseconds or less. Okay? So Bright Study are implementing a storage replica architecture, having a stretch cluster for host guardian services, and then that allows you then to live migrate host guardian, sorry, shielded VMs from one data center to another and be fully resilient at all levels. So at the storage level, at the host guardian level, but also then at the host, at the shared and wielded level. So then you've got a completely scale up, scale out, and resilient architecture from disk to the cloud. So this slide now just outlines the Dell 13G servers that will support for TPM. So there's TPM version 1.2 and TPM 2. Obviously, TPM 2 is the one you're most interested in because that's required to run shielded VMs on Hyper-V. Also, there are a number of servers that we will support for infield replacements. So if you've got a TPM version 1.2 server, some of those platforms will support replacing to TPM version 2. So you can actually then support VM shielding on that platform, 13G platform. And there's a URL at the bottom there that actually outlines all of the best practice that we have to how to configure a Dell 13G server for a TPM and how to enable it.
Terry, if I may, I think it's worth pointing out because we're focusing on it. The piece where TPM2 comes into play is related to the attestation mode that you configure. And I mentioned this rigorous health dance that goes on between Hyper-V and the host guardian's attestation service earlier on. That was assuming you were using the TPM2 trusted platform modules in the Hyper-V host. If, however, you haven't got those, and you're not lucky enough to have any of these machines, there is a secondary level, but you do lose a lot of the strong security assurances. Terry mentioned it earlier, but it's called admin-based, or AD mode, if you like. Instead of measuring the host's health, instead of measuring the boot path and the TPM and the code integrity policy, we simply look to see if it's a member of a group. So the Hyper-V host has to be added as a domain-joined computer account to a group whose security identifier, the SID, is then made known to the host guardian service. And rather than check its boot path and its health and its code integrity policy and its TPM's endorsement key, we simply say, does this SID exist in your session ticket that you just sent to me? And if it does, you're healthy. Now, of course, I'm hoping you can infer from that that this is nowhere near the set of assurances that we provide with TPM. Because I can attack the software on the host. I could attack Kerberos. I could attack Active Directory. All of those things represent attack vectors for that mode. But you can get a fully shielded VM. You can get an encryption-supported VM. And it is definitely a lot stronger than no shielding at all. But the attack vector becomes the fabric's peripheral piece, the host guardian service, the Active Directory. Terry's referring to here, if you want to go with the full bells and whistles, which is what Kenny is doing at Bright Solid, then you do need machines in the Hyper-V hosts with TPM v2. You do not need it in the host guardian service, but as we've just said, that's really only four nodes. Okay, sorry.
So, if you take the reference architecture today based on 2012 R2, we'll support that same reference architecture going to 2016. But it is overly complex. You'll see the details here where you know, you've got a lot of SATS cables, you've got a lot of network interconnects. So at the top there, you've got four just a bunch of disks, 240 disks in that's available for storage spaces. And we break them up into three pools of 80 disks. And then you've got four scale-out file server nodes. It's a shame we don't have the kind of the infrared, so I can just point to the screen and show you. But basically, at the top, you've got the four JBODs. The next line of servers are the storage spaces nodes. Then you've got two 10-gig switches, and you have two blades of 16 compute. So the idea is you can lose a blade, a switch, two storage nodes, and a JBOD, and the system will continue to scale. It's software-defined data center, okay? And you can support TPM2 in this architecture to be highly resilient. So the whole idea in a single data center, you have a fully resilient scale-up architecture. But it is complex. You have a lot of SAS cables, a lot of, you know, if you look at the back of a rack with this in place, there's a lot of heat. And what I'm going to outline is then, as we move to a hyper-converged Windows 2016 architecture, it changes substantially. So in this first part of the presentation, I'm just going to go over the Windows 2012 R2 piece, reintroduce Kenny to go through the operational aspects of VM shielding, Then I'll come in, I'm going to talk around the 2016 hyperconverged reference architectures, the price point, scale, resiliency, and what the substantial differences are, because they are substantial, okay? So if you take the current Bright Solid 2012 R2 architecture, you know, these are broad VMs, you know, how much memory, how many virtual cores per physical core, you know, how much physical disk space is relevant to the sizing. You know, to get 500 terabytes of available in a freeway mirror on storage spaces in 2012 R2, you need 1.5 petabytes of storage. Okay, this system will do fairly around 300,000 IOPS read, and its price point is about $300,000. Okay. Now, when I come back and go through the 2016 architecture, I'm going to use this as a reference and walk through the 2016 architecture that's equivalent to this, and then all the reference architectures we have, and the difference in price point, scale, and resiliency that we will offer. Okay? So, I'm now going to reintroduce Kenny to come back in and go through the optimization of Guardian Fabric.
Thanks. And what the hell, Terry? Our PO was way more than that. It wasn't really. Lots of wine, that's the key. Okay, so like I said before, we spent the last year and a half or so working on this. Since January, we've had the TPM modules available. We've put a lot of time and energy into working out how we actually bring it into operation. So not just install VM Shielding and Host Guardian service, but actually be able to offer it as a service to our customers. And it was great to see there are a lot of service providers in the room, but a lot of this is relevant to enterprise public sector as well. If you want to implement it in your own premises, or you want to move some of your workloads to a service provider, all of this is relevant. So this is going to be a lot of lists and questions, but bear with me because it's all relevant and I think interesting. Hopefully you'll think interesting. So the first thing you've got to consider is your contractual obligations and considerations. So if you're a service provider and you run a fully managed service today, you can't run a fully managed service on a shielded VM. So that's an immediate change to your model of operation. In the event of a failure, so the customer logs in and accidentally disables the NIC of their VM, how do you recover from that? Well, it's probably a recover from backup. Is that a change to your SLAs? Is it a change to how you interact with your customers? Do you need to revise your SLAs? Do you need to go through your contracts just now and change them for VM shielding versus normal VMs? This is one that surprised me because we hadn't thought about this. Auditability. Do you need to change how you license software inside a VM if you cannot see what's going on inside that VM? Do you need to change your contractual terms and conditions for your customers to protect you in the event of you being audited because you can't see what they've got installed? These are questions. I can't tell you how you operate your business, but hopefully provoke some thought. When you offer a guarded fabric to customers, it's not just going to attract the right sorts of customers. If you offer it as a log onto our site, deploy the VM, it's shielded. Well, some people that sail the high seas of the internet may want to get involved in this. They may want to come onto your fabric, hide in there where no one can see what they're doing. That's not something that we really want. So we already vet all of our customers. We already vet them. We already take them through a process. We get to know them all. Just something to bear in mind. You also want to make sure that you're protecting all your other tenants from the actions of questionable characters. Again, we have the scenario where people that sail the high seas of the internet come into your fabric, do lots of nasty things, you may end up getting raided. We don't want to get raided. That impacts our other customers. So again, we vet the customers, we make sure we know what workloads are going to run, then we shield them. So it's all about trust, multi-way trust between tenant, between customer, between us and other customers. Because we can't get into a shielded VM if anything breaks, backups become even more critical to recovery. You may want to add extra backup points. You may want to backup more than once a day. Maybe you want to add in production checkpoints now. Backups are core. In a shielded VM, when it's fully shielded, you won't get any application aware or in-guest processing type things. You'll get crash-consistent backups, unless it's an encryption-supported VM, in which case everything just works as it always has. Works perfectly. It's only in the fully shielded model that you don't get the in-guest backup processing. Some people think that you can add an agent inside the VM to do in-guest backups. That breaks the security model. You're taking that data out, probably unencrypted, or if it's encrypted, you probably run and own the keys. That breaks the security model. So no, if you're running a guarded fabric, don't do that, would be my advice. You can, but don't. And then there are some backup products which will validate the integrity of the backup, make sure it works, by spinning that backup up, checking it boots, and then spinning it back down. Those products will not work with a shielded VM. Actually, I'll caveat that. We have not tested it on a small-scale guarded fabric that the backup environment is able to spin up in. Not tried it. Maybe someone else wants to try it.
Caveat confirmed.
Caveat confirmed. Good. So the host guardian service that we've talked a fair bit about now becomes critical infrastructure to your entire environment. If you want your VMs to attest properly, the HGS has to work. We implement a four-node stretch cluster across sites, so we have site resiliency, and so we can migrate between multiple data centers through a single HGS fabric. We, and I don't think anyone, has operated a VM shielded environment at massive scale yet, so we're not entirely certain, and I'll go to Dean in a minute to maybe confirm this. We're not 100% certain about if you'll need to expand your HGS as you expand the number of shielded VMs, the number of devices doing attestation. I don't know if you have any numbers there at all, Dean, or
so we ran a fair number of tests on this. It is difficult to say because the frequency of interactions with the host guardian service does vary. There is an original attestation interaction, which is about making sure that the host has a health certificate. That health certificate lasts for 8 hours. Once I've got the health cert, you don't need to attest again. You present the health cert. Now you present the health cert, rather like you do a TGT, to release keys. Those interactions depend on, one, how frequently you're powering up new shielded VMs, or two, how frequently existing VMs that are shielded, running, are now being live migrated. We have another interaction then because we have to make sure that the target of the live migration operation will pass the rigorous health attestation tests. Otherwise, we're not going to send the shielded VM there. That would be pointless. Mm-hmm. The interactions we've seen is that a single machine running on commodity server hardware was quite happily able to handle 800 attestation events without triggering a timeout on any of them. Now, I don't want to be more specific on that because I don't think that we have production scale data to quote anything more specific from that. But if, like me, you're inferring from that 3 is going to be able to service in the same way as AD does 10,000 authentication attempts, I don't think, and I stress the word I don't think you'll be over-exaggerating it. My guess is that will be just fine. But we need a little bit more time to put together some kind of production deployment and then test it ourselves with what we consider to be production kinds of interactions, which is really where we're missing the data right now. Kenny is basically going to be the one that provides us with it.
Okay. Yeah, if loads of people buy it from us. Okay, so there's an interesting question/conundrum that comes up when you're deploying the HGS, which is you have the option of deploying it into an existing domain, or you can deploy a new domain. And we spent a long time humming and hawing over what we would do here. And the first thought was that we would just deploy this into our existing management domain. We already trust it. It is secure-ish. And we bring that forward to 2016, and we build our HGS into that. But there were too many caveats, too many unknowns. There's too many legacy that you bring forward when you do that, too much legacy. And what we've actually settled on is building onto a new trusted Bastion domain, which is going to be our HGS domain, and it's going to be brought forward into Azure Stack as well. And that's, I think, probably the best practice model for a service provider. I guess for an enterprise, you probably want to deploy into an existing domain, but these are choices that you have. We've chosen to go the route of creating a new domain and making that the most trusted, most secure domain that we have. So one question I have that I'd love to get feedback on maybe after or during Q&A is, does anyone think there's appetite for stretch HGS, either from your data centers to a service provider or to Azure or so on? So just food for thought. Any feedback would be appreciated there. Here's one tiny tip I have, which is like a little Halo command that's in the host guardian service deployment. So it's a PowerShell commandlet, get HGS trace. And you can run it at any step of the deployment through the HGS, and it will tell you what's working, what's not, and every single product that Microsoft makes should have something like this in it, because the deployment of the HGS is not necessarily the most simple process, and anything that makes it easier is wonderful. And not many people know about this, and it is your friend. So a shielded VM and an encryption-supported VM is fundamentally different for a customer than a normal VM. And customer education is going to be critical in making it a success, whether it's in your own enterprise or at a service provider. So we need to teach them and have education packs and sessions available for what is the difference between a fully shielded versus an encryption-supported VM. When do you want to use one versus the other? Our thought is that just now, fully shielded would be for any HR data, any financial data, domain controllers, any IPR, for sure. You may have other ideas. Encryption supported, what we want to do is move that to be a default for supported operating systems. So the more OSs you can support, Dean, the better for us. So we want to make encryption supported the default, because you lose nothing and you gain a lot. You need to teach them about the benefits and trade-offs. So if they're used to you being able to console onto a VM, fix it for them, and return it to them, that's gone. You need to be able to teach them the benefits of that from a security perspective, so that if they have audit compliance requirements, they can communicate the benefit of the VM shielding, what that achieves in their auditing. And there's, if you provide WAP or you use WAP in your enterprise, there is new functionality within, sorry, it's called App now, right? Azure Pack. Scratch the W, it's not there. So there's new functionality in there for creating shielding data in order to shield a VM or make it encryption supported, and how to use that and how to create shielding data are things that customers aren't going to know. They will need a 2016 VM or server of some sort to run the VM shielding data creation wizard. They will need to manage their own keys. They will need to probably create a signed RDP session, RDP file. They will need to maybe create an unattend file. Maybe they want to create their own shielded VHDX that they share with you and put into your environment. These are all new things for the customer who's just used to coming to you and going, click deploy. Education's king there, but it's education for the benefit of security. So we said earlier that if a VM is damaged, if it's not accessible over the network, then you've lost access to it. You can't repair it. You have to restore from backup. That's not entirely true. There is this concept of the repair garage, which I would say shouldn't be used in all eventualities, but if you have a backup that's a day ago and you have to absolutely recover data from 2 hours ago, the repair garage here offers you that option. Basically, it uses nested Hyper-V virtualization to create a new shielded VM, which is also a Hyper-V host. We can then bring the broken shielded VM inside that. We can reduce its level of shielding to encryption supported. It is still shielded from the fabric because it's within a shielded nested Hyper-V host. The customer can then console, well, they can RDP onto that nested Hyper-V host. They can console onto the encryption supported VM, fix it, reshield it, then bring it back out.
Can I interject there real quick? What do you guys think of that as a solution to a shielded VM is busted? The reason that we built this is because we got feedback when we first demonstrated shielded VMs, and customers said, you're making me choose between security and supportability. And we said, no, good point. So we came up with this concept of encryption supported. And then the customers said, you're making me choose between security and something that's not as good, encryption supported or supportability. And went, yeah, good point. So then we came up with, well, actually, encryption supported is far more suitable for compliance scenarios because you get all the checkboxes, but you can still support it because you've got a console connection. But we still need to solve, I want security and supportability. So we came up with something that we've operationalized into a series of scripts called a repair garage. As Kenny said, it leverages nested Hyper-V, where you've got a nested Hyper-V VM owned by the same guy that owns the broken VM, and you park the broken shielded VM inside it. You have to then possess the owner keys. We have a notion of an owner key as part of a key protector that goes on every single shielded or encryption-supported VM. The owner key is the only thing that entitles you to change the policy from shielded to encryption supported. That was the main point I wanted to make. So for that part in the repair garage to work, Kenny would have had to have been the owner of the original VM, possess the owner keys, and then either put them inside the repair garage or bring the key protector back on premises where the keys reside, flip the policy there, and then send the policy back up, which is arguably the more secure path. The keys never left on premises, only the changed policy left. But we're not saying that anybody can do this. The fabric itself, so Kenny has Bright Solid, cannot change the policy of a shielded VM to encryption-supported VM unless you have somehow allowed the owner keys to leak to Kenny. As the VM owner, you're the only person able to change that policy. Hopefully that little addition there makes some sense. Mm. Do you think this sounds like a reasonable solution? So the question there was, Hyper-V replica failover is completely out of the picture? Nope. No, we don't care. As long as the TPM goes along for the ride when a machine is moved from one host to another, and as long as the target host is blessed as healthy, and as long as it is part of a host guardian service that has the ability to crack the key protector. That doesn't mean it has to be the same one as the one you were originally talking about, because each shielded VM can be blessed to run on an unlimited number of fabrics. So I can say it runs on Fabric 1 in the north of Scotland. I can say it runs on Fabric 2 in the south of England, a far more modern place with electricity and stuff. Got you now. Give me a microphone, I'll take it back. So you can simply set it up like that. You could even say, hopefully at some point in the future, perhaps Azure supports shielded VMs. We are working hard to get that done, but it's going to take us a while because of the sheer scale of Azure to get that done. You would be able to say Azure is also blessed. Nobody else is. Somebody steals it, they try and run it on AWS, it doesn't power up. They take it home, they try and run it on Hyper-V, it doesn't power up. They put it onto a Hyper-V host that is healthy, using a host guardian service who can crack the keys, it powers up. Hmm. That's basically the model. Okay, good, that's me.
Good, yep. So this is a tenant-owned, customer-owned, hoster-supported scenario. So you have to be in absolute lockstep going through this to make sure you each do your bit of the process to make sure it works. So again, this is right down to that customer education piece and making sure everyone knows their roles in achieving this. Okay, I promised I would do this one heartfelt plea, which is SMB1 is enabled by default in 2016, still, disable it. You're creating a guarded fabric, the security holes in SMB1 are well known, well documented, so just go into your remove roles and features and kill it, please. And if you don't trust me, trust Ned. Ned is one of the owners of SMB at Microsoft. And if you go to his Twitter feed, you will just see, well.
Microsoft did not bless this slide.
Pause. I'm not Microsoft. I can say what I want. Pause, reflect, water. Okay, the other thing that we always have to remember is that a shielded VM, a guarded fabric, does not protect what goes on within the VM. So a tenant can still log into that VM and bring malware in. They can still disable the NIC. They can still cause damage. We can't protect tenants from themselves.
It's my favorite by far.
I put this one in so I'd have time to have a drink of water. So I'll just do a loop. I could watch this all day, but let's not. I spoke about padding the session, it helps. Sorry, still laughing. Remember to feedback on the session. Laughs were had. Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about here is pricing. Now, a lot of people think maybe if you want to have a shielded VM, it's going to cost more. And that's not the model Bright Solid are adopting. What we have decided is that a shielded VM, an encryption-supported VM, is going to cost the exact same to our customers as a normal VM. The management overhead, the cost of infrastructure, is de minimis to us in terms of in comparison to the features and benefits our customers get. We never want to be squeezing our customers for security. We never want them to have to choose between security and budget. So if they need the security, it should be inherent. It should be there. So that's the model we're adopting, and that's the model we'll have going forward. So with our 2016 guarded fabric, our customers will be able to take free proof of concepts, test out the functionality, and if they want to take advantage of encryption-supported or fully shielded VMs, they can move to that, and it costs them no more than it costs now. That's a message I really want to convey, because I think if you really want to grow this in the market, it's an important way to bring it to market.
Does anyone else want to work for Bright Solid too? Just wondering. Yeah.
He does. He has a far more broad accent than me. You wouldn't understand him. No. Okay, so we've got the self-indulgent bit now. We've got a little video that we put together last week, and I'm going to play this, then pass back to Terry. And I think that's it for me other than Q&A, so thanks all.
Bright Solid have an enormous appetite for innovation. It's core to our DNA. We have a dedicated emerging technologies team to make sure that we're always looking to the forefront of the market, always trying to lead the market and help our customers as much as we possibly can. And we do that really by encouraging every single person within the business to bring forward ideas, and when they do, to run with them and see where we can bring them, because it's only by working together that we can really bring out the true innovation of the business. We've been very heavily involved in working on the Windows Server 2016 launch, so a couple of the features that we're really focused and working on and very closely working with Microsoft on are Shielded VMs and Storage Replica, because two of the core pillars of Windows Server 2016 are security and data assurance. And those are core pillars of BrightSolid's business as well.
It's a very good question. Simply put, what are shielded VMs?
A shielded VM is a simple concept. It's a VM where only the owner has access to it.
It was a surprise to me that we actually sold clouds without this capability. Because it's kind of one of those things where you go, what? You know, and it probably happened in space programs when people, you sent that rocket up and it didn't have what on it? You know, how did they do that? And I think people will look back and say, how the heck did they sell clouds without this capability?
One of the last big trip hazards to the cloud for our customers has been that knowledge and understanding of who can see my data, who can access my data. What a shielded VM does is it breaks down that trip hazard, allows the customer to bring their data into our data centers with full confidence and assurance, with the knowledge that it will be safe. And that really gives them the flexibility, the agility, the cost savings inherent to cloud, but with the security and data assurance that they want and need.
The bit that took me a little while to get my head around it, because I'm not the biggest technologist of all time, was if I run shielded VMs and I have data passing through this fabric and it ends back up on the disk, it's encrypted through the shielded VM. So if someone runs off with your encrypted data, they can't run it anywhere else. That's big.
The customers that we're seeing that would have immediate benefit from shielded VMs are the ones with the more mature enterprise security wrappers already in place. So we're talking about larger enterprises that understand the need for security. Generally speaking, those enterprises also have compliance and auditors and regulations, which are a higher standard. And so those would be the first adopters. However, I think rather soon, the adoption will be widespread. The benefits are well understood.
So BrightSolid have the world's first production-ready hoster deployment of a guarded fabric which can host shielded VMs. What that really means is that when Windows Server 2016 launches in October, we will be able to go straight to market with this. We'll be running free proof of concepts for our customers to be able to test the VM shielding concept, make sure that it's right for them, make sure they understand any caveats, any nuances they need to understand, and be able to move forward from there.
Shielded VMs are going to change the way we look at cloud. That is absolutely clear. It's going to enable us to position the cloud in all scenarios as the secure solution. In fact, the most secure solution.
Thanks to Kenny for getting all that information put together. Thanks very much, Kenny. And at this point, we'll pass it back over to Terry, who's going to talk about some of the servers and get to show you some of the price point deltas here. When he showed me these price differences, because I've told Terry it can't be a sales pitch, he understands, the price point deltas are monumentally different for exactly the same or better scale, close to half the price, but I'll let Terry talk to that.
Okay, so the idea around the Windows 2016 reference architecture is it's simple, repeatable, and it's scalable, and just but it's really affordable, okay? So does the button work? Hey. So just to reiterate the reference architecture that we have with BrightSolid and 2012 R2, and the scale, the storage, the IOPS, and the price point. When you look at the Windows 2016 equivalent, you're looking at this. Look at the complexity between a disaggregated solution and a hyper-converged solution, okay? So this is 8 2U servers running the same amount of capacity. There's more resiliency, there's more IOPS, and it's actually a lot more cost-effective. And the idea of this reference architecture is that it is just Ethernet. There's no SAS cables, there's no JBODs, this is just hyper-converged. And these servers just talk to each other across those two switches, which are resilient. Okay, so this is Spaces Direct, Hyper-V, with set switching, embedded set switching. And this just, you know, allows you to run the similar amount of VMs that BrightSolid are running today. So And this fits in as an engineered solution, so you can buy as a rack or you buy as bricks and blocks, and you can design the solution to fit your scale, resiliency, and your availability. So what is the price point of this? Well, $170,000 compared to $300,000. So that's substantial difference for what you bought a year ago to what you can buy today with Windows 2016. Okay? This is where we begin and it becomes game-changing. So in a 2-1U solution, okay, which is 2 200-gig SSDs and 6 1-terabyte HDDs, is $17,000 to run 50 shielded or crypted VMs. The reason why, it doesn't require switches. It has an interconnect between the two, which can be a dual 10-gig Intel, it could be a dual 10-gig Mellanox card, 40-gig Mellanox card. So switches on their own to run 10-gig and run DCB and PFC, because RoCE 2 requires that for flow control and prioritization and VLAN tagging. You don't need that with a 2-node. You can just have an interconnect between the two. So what does that look like? So that red wire is just a dual 10-gig interconnect. And with set teaming, embedded set teaming in Hyper-V, you set up each port as a different subnet, and RDMA will continue without failure between the two nodes. So that's actually 20 gig of RDMA for live migration, cluster comms, redirected I/O. And on the system board, you've got a dual 1 gig or dual 10 gig to connect to the existing fabric. Okay? There's nothing out there that we believe is available at anything like this scale and price point from a VM's capacity, resiliency, and IOPS perspective. We go higher. So we have a larger storage footprint. So this is a 4U solution. It's all TPM2, so it all support VM shielding and encrypted VMs. Okay. So on a 4U system, again with no switches, that's $26,000. And that allows you to go to 12 10-terabyte drives, 120 terabytes in a two-way mirror. That's 120 terabytes available. Okay. If you take the space's direct calculations, a little bit less. But this essentially can allow you to run 520 VMs. Again, the interconnect is a dual 10 gig, 40 gig interconnect between the two. Okay? So this is where it becomes much more simpler. It's bricks and blocks that you just build. And this is just the beginning. So we go into a all-flash solution. So this is a 24-disk solution, which gives you NVMe, SSD, and read-intensive SSD. So you can have write-intensive NVMEs, you can have mixed-use SSDs, and then read-intensive SSDs to give you a free-tier caching system that gives you immense IOPS and very good capacity for $80,000. Okay? If you look at an equivalent solution to that, you won't even come anywhere close to that. The reason why? The two switches to give you resiliency interconnect will cost you $15,000 to $20,000, depending on the switches that you buy. You don't require them. So imagine in your rack, you can just keep buying, building two-node systems, more two-node systems. You're buying storage, you're buying IOPS, you're buying virtual machines, you're not buying networking switches, okay? This is great for small, medium businesses, for branch office, for point solutions, okay? This is a two-way mirror. It allows you to lose one node or one disk. It's like a RAID 1 capability. It gives you 50% available capacity, okay? As we go further forward, you go from a 2-node to a 4-node, you need switches, okay? This allows you to run SSDs and HDDs to give you 480 terabytes of available storage, but with a multi-resilient volume, it gives you 50% available capacity of that, so 220 terabytes of available storage for $100,000. And we continue, 8 nodes, okay? This is the equivalent solution for Bright Solid. So the IOPS capacity resiliency at that price point is $130,000 less price from a more simpler solution. There's less cables, less heat, less power, less use space taken up, and a better price point. And this is not the end of it. We continue up to 16 nodes. Okay? So what happens if we want to go further? Right? So for 16 nodes, for $280,000, okay? We continue to a complete four-node flash solution. So this, the amount of IOPS you can get onto this, it depends on the amount of cores you have, the RDMA interconnect between the nodes. You know, you can pick and choose your price point, capacity, and the types of SSDs, NVMEs you want in the solution. And it's all really down to the amount of thermals and how much we can put into a single box. But these are game-changing solutions that you do not need to fill up a complete rack now. You can build these solutions into a smaller set of bricks and blocks to give you the capacity, the resiliency, and the IOPS. And again, we can continue further. So a complete flash solution with 92 terabytes available is around this ballpark. So these ballpark figures are what we work with the Dell sales team to give an average cost, okay? And in some instances, they'll be lower. We continue. So we take that architecture and we apply rack fault tolerance now. These four racks can be two racks in each data center. Okay, which could be a data room in two data centers with a fast interconnect. And we can have 1,000 VMs in a 16-node hyperconverge, another 1,000 VMs, another 1,000 VMs, another 1,000 VMs. Okay, you can lose two racks, a rack and a node, a rack and a disk, two of something, and the system will continue. So that's VMs, and that's storage. It's software-defined data center, using the same bricks and blocks. Imagine I want to bring the left-hand rack into maintenance mode. The health service within the cluster would make sure that the storage is highly available on the remaining racks. The virtual machines are drained and moved to remaining nodes in the cluster, and it will allow you to put that rack into maintenance mode. You can now apply firmware updates to the whole rack. So all the disk firmware, to all the compute, all the network adapters, you've never been able to do that before, okay? So we're taking this to the next level, okay? So that's 4,000 VMs. And these are just average VMs, and it's completely hyperconverged. What happens if you want to scale out further, okay? So you can start with hyperconverge. You can still scale out file server onto that 16-node cluster and start adding compute separate, Hyper-V compute separate from storage. And that Hyper-V compute can be running shielded VMs, TPM version 2, encrypted VMs. So that's a 32-node cluster, another 32-node cluster, another 32-node cluster, and keep growing and keep scaling out, if this button would work, and keep going, okay? So in this architecture, we can put four servers in a 2U, and because we have one network adapter which allows us to have convergence, we can actually now go to actually eight servers in a 2U. So actually, for each rack, four racks, we can put 64 node clusters in place. Now, with the right processors and the right memory limits, we can be consistent with thermals. And we have an ESSA tool that allows us to actually build the solutions to match the levels of VMs and scale with TPM2 in this platform for shielded and encrypted VMs. So I don't know if you've seen any of this in previous sessions, but this allows you to scale up and scale out in a way that's never been possible before. And it's a lot simpler. And you can start small and keep growing. You can start at hyperconverged and then change to converged with no downtime. I don't know of any system that allows you to do that, to start on a 2-node and grow up to a 16-node, a hyperconverged, and then move to a converged platform and separate Hyper-V and storage while maintaining business as usual. So shielded VMs, maintaining business as usual from a hyper-converged to a converged, okay? So think about that. And you can keep on scaling out. So literally, you can go from two nodes to 384 nodes running VMs and separate and growing storage aligned with VMs, Hyper-V, and to the point where storage and VMs need to be separated. And it allows you to continue scaling up. You can add storage replica to this and replicate your storage between two data centers. If you have a fast interconnect between two data rooms, two racks can be in one data room, and two racks can be in another. And they will communicate the cluster comms between them, line migration between them, the storage replication between them, the space is direct communication between them, as long as it's LAN-based and low latency. Okay? So just give you a feel for what is possible in the architecture. There's a lot more to this, but just give you a flavor, okay? So I'm gonna finish there. I'm gonna hand over back over to Dean, and here you go.
Great, thank you very much, Terry. Clicker. Thank you. Okay, so that was some 18,000 VMs running in that last solution. Pretty insane. All right, so we'll wrap it up then. Let's just give you a quick review then. So if I show you a comparison, bare metal, regular VM, shielded VM. Let's go down and see who has access to this, see if we can entice you to take a look at these things a little more closely. In the case of a server admin, they have access to bare metal. They're supposed to. They have access to a Hyper-V host. Well, should not have access, but does. And in the case of a shielded virtual machine, they don't have access. If you go down that list, you can see there's a little legend at the bottom that tells you what we're trying to convey there. Shielded VMs flip the checkbox back to across in exactly the right ways. We're taking away the ability for these artifacts to be copied off and reused as though they're the original, because they're meaningless blurs of nothing, encrypted blobs, large files that they can do nothing with. Today, a USB stick is an attack vector against the Hyper-V host. It's an attack vector against a VMware host, against a Citrix Xen host. It is no longer an attack vector if shielded VMs are in play. And the key release criteria here is extremely strong. I cannot stress that enough. If any of you have some specific questions on how that works, we have a deep dive session coming up later this week. It's co-hosted by myself and the owner, Lars, from the Hyper-V team, who owns the technologies that underpin shielded VM in Hyper-V itself. So we get encryption of data, both at rest and in flight. Fabric admins are locked out. So are SAN administrators, printer admins, network admins. All of them are locked out. And we have an attestation requirement before we will release keying material to those Hyper-V hosts that ensures no malware has infected that box. We will not permit shielded VMs or encryption-supported VMs to run on hosts that do not pass our rigorous health attestation. Likely use cases, obviously Kenny represents a public cloud. Private cloud makes an awful lot of sense here as well for strong separation of duty. At this point in time, there are many, many workloads with one specific shining knight that is rarely virtualized, and it's near and dear to my heart, Active Directory domain controllers. People don't virtualize them today because it kind of blurs the line between a fabric admin and a domain admin. Because if a fabric admin has any malicious intention, it's just a matter of time before they inherit the domain admin password by attacking the directory database. And I already showed you I can do that with a double-click attack in many of the other sessions. And if you'd like to see the double-click attack, as we call it, I can do that again in another session a little bit later this week. Branch office, this one's interesting. A branch office where you want to run sensitive workloads, where sensitive data needs to exist, but today you don't deploy the workload there, you don't deploy the disk there, because it can't be protected due to the physical insecurity that can't be maintained in a branch office. Deploy it as a shielded VM and leave the host guardian service back in the data center so that the keys to the kingdom aren't there. Remember, you only need to interact with the host guardian service once every 8 hours for attestation purposes and then to power the VM on. If it goes down and the shielded VM is still running in the branch office, then it's still running. If it goes down, then sure, now you do have a problem. And for vNext, my team and I are looking at coming up with a caching mechanism, which we've actually already prototyped. It's just not available in Server 2016, so that shielded VMs could have the policy of, yes, you're healthy, extended just a little bit to allow a broken system to at least power up a shielded VM. And then last but not least, compliance. Obviously, we've already talked about that. Here's an example of all the compliance mappings we've done. We had this handled for us by an independent third party, and there are compliance mappings in here for PIM, the Privileged Identity Management capabilities, and a variety of others as well. This one is specific to shielded VMs. All right. Those are the related sessions. That's it from the three of us. I will thank you again to my two guests. I appreciate your efforts there, and thank you for listening. Appreciate it.
Are you taking questions? Hello? Are you taking questions? Or no? I guess not.
Yeah, questions are absolutely. Just please come on up to the front. We've got much time for Q&A. So if you've got questions, please do. Come up to the front.